Hi, everybody. Tom Kalinske has had a career as the king of brands. Tom first became well-known for marketing Flintstone Vitamins and then reviving Barbie and Hot Wheels at Mattel and then launching Masters of the Universe. In the games industry, and perhaps most famously, Tom's efforts to turn around Sega of America were chronicled in the book and recent CBS documentary, Console Wars. Tom famously turned around the Sega console business, growing Sega of America from $72 million to more than $1.5 billion in revenue. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Joseph. It's good to be with you.
I thought we could first start by actually talking, kind of going back into your career and talking about sort of one of the first achievements that kind of made you famous, which was when you helped market Flintstones Vitamins. Can you take us back to that experience and maybe tell us a little bit more about kind of the backstory behind the Flintstones Vitamins? How was it conceived? And then how did you market the vitamins?
Sure. So that takes me all the way back to 1968. I was out of graduate school and I joined a part of J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency in New York City that developed new products for existing clients. And one of their clients was Miles Laboratories, the guys who make one-a-day vitamins and Alka-Seltzer. And they also made a children's chewable vitamin called Chox, which was a square chocolate-flavored vitamin. Well, one day, Bristol-Myers, their competitor, came out with PALS vitamins, which were multicolored, fruit-flavored, animal-shaped vitamins. And guess what? The Chox business literally fell off a cliff. It just disappeared. It went from, you know, $50 million to nothing. And the Miles Laboratories people said to us, you got to develop a new vitamin for us that we can compete with Bristol-Myers PALS vitamins with. And so we did all this research. The J. Walter Thompson Company also had a big research group, an arm, and we researched every conceivable theme and character and what have you. And actually, the winning concept, this will surprise you, was actually Snoopy and his characters. Well, Snoopy was already taken for nutritional products by Interstate Baking. And the brand that came, or the characters that came in second, were Flintstones. And yet at the time, Flintstones was a primetime animated television show. And I don't know if you guys can remember that, but it was sort of like a takeoff of the Jackie Gleason Honeymooners show, only in animated form with Fred Flintstone and Wilma and Barney and the Flintmobile and what have you. So anyway, that was the second choice. So we go out to Miles Laboratories in Elkhart, Indiana, and we had all these drawings of what Flintstones vitamins would look like. And we presented it to the management there, and they looked at us and said, you guys are nuts. You don't know what you're talking about. The show just went from primetime to Saturday morning, which was true. It had been canceled off primetime. It was now on Saturday morning. And we said, well, that's good. That means more kids are going to see it. And they basically threw us out of the room and said, go do your more research. So we did. We did more research. And it came out, this time we didn't include Snoopy. And the Flintstones came out number one. So we go back out there and we say to these executives, who were mostly doctors, by the way, at Miles Laboratories, we say, you got to do Flintstones vitamins. And the head doctor was a guy named Ollie Joy. We used to call him O-Joy. And he looked at us and he said, well, if that's the best you guys can do, you'll have to come out here and live here in Elkhart, Indiana, and put this together as a brand, and then we'll do it. So that basically is what happened. I went out to Elkhart and spent quite a bit of time out there. I used to fly back and forth between New York and Elkhart almost every week. And we introduced Flintstones. We obviously did the packaging. Obviously, Miles did the nutritional content of the vitamins. And we introduced it with a very catchy animated, it was the first time I think a rotoscope, a commercial had been done with using rotoscope, which was we shot on a green screen, which is very common today, and we included the Flintstones characters doing things with real children, you know, climbing a mountain next to Fred Flintstone, singing yabba dabba doo, yabba dabba doo, Flintstones vitamins are good to chew. And it caught on, and it literally became the number one vitamin in a few weeks and surpassed Miles PALS vitamins. And the strange thing is, all these years later, now we're talking about introducing this in 1969, it's still the number one children's chewable vitamin.
Yeah, I remember eating those vitamins when I was a kid as well. But yeah, that's great. So it sounds like even from those days, there was a focus on data and research and things of that nature. And, you know, I think in the mobile gaming industry, which where I'm from, a big focus is on research and you know, making sure we're as data driven as possible. But was there any, during that time, was there any part of you that, was it just about the data? Was it just the research? Or was there any kind of gut feeling to the vitamins as well?
Well, no, I think it was both data. Obviously, the research proved the data. But it was also a gut feeling because I will tell you, most of the so-called experts, and this is sort of a common theme that I've run across, the experts in the industry, and in this case, it was the vitamin industry and the licensing industry, they thought this was a bad idea. But my feeling was that it was an excellent idea. And as I said a minute ago, the fact that children were now watching it on Saturday morning was a good thing, not a bad thing for Miles Laboratories. And so my gut said, this is something we need to do and we need to stick with it. And of course they did.
Right. And then like in terms of the next phase in your career, in terms of the story behind Barbie and Hot Wheels, could you take us back to that time and how did you revive those brands? And what did you see in those brands in particular that got you excited about trying to turn those around?
Sure. By the way, Flintstones in a way introduced me to Mattel.
Okay.
Because in 1969, the Senate Subcommittee on Children's Advertising was formed, and the senators were mad at toy advertising and cereal advertising and candy advertising, and somehow we got thrown into that mix. Right. So we were called before the Senate Subcommittee in Washington, D.C., which was a very unpleasant experience because the senators sit on these mahogany desks kind of up high above you, and you're down on your folding iron chair in front on a formica table, very uncomfortable, usually with a lawyer next to you, and the senators are asking you questions. And so they really crucified Kellogg's and General Mills and a lot of the toy guys. Mattel was there. And then at one point, Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine pointed at me and she said, "So, Mr. Kalinske, you think selling drugs to children is a good idea?" And I said, "Well, Senator, I'm sure you're aware that moms try their darndest to get their kids to eat properly, to eat vegetables and fruits. But a lot of times the kids just won't do it. And so moms actually are very thankful that they have Flintstones vitamins to give their kids because now they know they're getting the right vitamins and minerals and nutritions to the child." And let me read a letter to you from one of those moms. And so I pulled out a letter and I read it to the Senate. And then I had a mailbag full of letters and I picked it up and I said, "I have 5,000 more letters. Would you like me to read some more of them to you?" And she said, "That'll be enough, Mr. Kalinske." Nobody asked me another question. Well, the Mattel guys thought that was hysterical. And so at the end of that session, they out in the hallway, they said, "Hey, we kind of like your act. Why don't you come out to Hawthorne, California, an interview for a position with Mattel." And so I did. So that's what got me to Mattel. And I moved from New York City to Los Angeles, and Hawthorne's a little suburb of Los Angeles. And I started as a product manager on preschool toys, Jack in the Boxes, C&C's, Putt-Putt Railroads, Tough Stuff Toys. And about all I accomplished there, I did help grow that business, introduce the red and white packaging that Mattel, I think, still uses on preschool toys today. And one day, after working on this business and improving it somewhat, the founder of Mattel, one of the founders, Ruth Handler, walked into my cubicle, which happened to be outside the ladies' room, so I got a lot of visitors. And she was a salty old character. She swore a lot. And I won't do that part of it. But anyway, she said, "Tom, the sales force says it's over for Barbie. Barbie sales declined last year. It fell from $100 million to $42 million. The buyers at the retail store say it's over for Barbie. The Wall Street analysts say it's over for Barbie. And they say it's time to go on to something else. What do you think of all that?" And I said, "Ruth, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Barbie will be around long after you and I are gone." She said, "That's what I want to hear. I'm going to talk to Ray." Ray was my boss. "I'm going to talk to Ray about putting you on the Barbie business." And so that was how I got on the Barbie business. But before she left my cubicle, I said to her, I said, "Ruth, by the way, why do you think Barbie is so special? What makes her so great?" And she said, "Because with Barbie, a girl can be anything she wants to be. And I ended up using those exact words, that phrase, on packaging and promotions and advertising from that day forward. And I was put on the Barbie business. And your question, I guess, is what did I see and how did I turn it around? Well, I really believed in this brand. I really believed what Ruth said, that through a girl's imagination with Barbie, she could be anything she wanted to be. And so at the time, the brand was in really bad shape. And the reason, in my opinion at the time, was that the people on the business were so used to doing things the same way, year after year after year. And they would introduce one new lead doll, they'd introduce one range of costumes or fashions for it, they'd introduce one low-priced accessory and one high-priced accessory, and maybe every 3 years they'd introduce a new friend, you know, whether it was Francie or Midge or Skipper or whoever, to the brand. And I thought, well, this is nuts. You know, this is really, oh, and by the way, the packaging was all over the map. You know, Barbie was in a red package. Her friends were in brown packages or green packages. Ken, I think, was in a brown package, actually. The accessories would be in yellow packaging. And so it was a mess at retail. So that's what I inherited. That's what I walked into. And basically, I said, this is crazy, and we're not going to do it that way anymore. We're going to do things a lot differently. Right. And so part of the strategy was obviously putting all the packaging in pink, everything, right, to create a pink wall at retail. And then I introduced a low-priced Barbie for a price range doll. I introduced a very high-priced, fashion-oriented doll. Did deals with famous designers like Oscar de la Renta. Did action dolls, where a gymnast doll. But most importantly, I did occupations. And so I think the first occupation we did was actually Pilot Barbie. Mm-hmm. And then we did Dr. Barbie and Teacher Barbie. And that got to this point that Ruth had said, with Barbie, you can be anything you want to be. And sure enough, the business fairly quickly turned around. And we grew from 42 million to, I don't remember the exact numbers now, it's so long ago, but we literally doubled, went from 42 to 80 something to 150 to 300 to 450 to 550. And it became obviously a very successful brand.
Right. And so, Tom, it sounds like in looking at Barbie, clearly you aren't the target audience for Barbie, but what you saw was you saw the ability for that audience to aspire to something that, based upon like the comments that you got from Ruth, was it?
Ruth Handler, yes.
Right. And so then it seemed like that's what helped you map to different careers and professions and things like that.
Exactly.
And then maybe the other, it sounds like one of the lessons that I think is relevant today was just in terms of complacency, right? And so like as a product manager in a lot of companies, it's like there are these teams that are so used to just doing the same thing over and over, but sometimes it might be wise to, as you did with Barbie, look at how are the teams doing the different things, their processes, and look at every area and try to see if there are ways of improving those areas. Would you say that's fair?
That's correct. And by the way, I really agree with you on the complacency thing. I think complacency and arrogance are the two great sins that product managers can make. and right, often they make both at the same time. And again, you notice in my opening remarks that once again, the experts in the industry, whether they're right, sales experts or retail experts or Wall Street experts, all thought it was over for Barbie. That you should give up, go on to something else. Well, that also was wrong. It was just plain wrong. And so looking at the business with a new, fresh eye, I guess, and thinking about how do I segment this market? How do I segment it so there's a real easy way for people without much income to buy a Barbie doll at a very low price, because I think it was $3.50 at the time. Or for those who are collectors and want real high-priced products, how do I attract them? Right. And then in the middle, how do I get girls who are interested in becoming a doctor, perhaps, to play with Barbie, or they want to become a teacher to play with Barbie. And if for those who are more action-oriented, how do I do a doll that can actually do things, a gymnast doll, for example, or a ballerina Barbie that actually can dance? And so all of those segments of the market were right, what I went after. I very purposefully segmented the market. One example of that is something we did, which we called My First Barbie, which was a doll that was very easy to dress for young girls because it only had Velcro snaps and snaps, no buttons, no, nothing hard to do. no tying of shoes or things like that. And so that was another segment that we went after.
Right. And maybe the general principle there, if I were to try and generalize the principle that you're speaking to, is that when you talk about experts, the real experts are actually the people who understand the customer, the audience. And one of the things that you were able to do is to understand who the customers are and then to cater the product or to change the products to adapt to each of the customer segments that you saw.
That's correct. Okay. And also, we were very aggressive, again, in marketing, in advertising.
Right.
One thing that we did that, gosh, today it's probably illegal. We did one of our competitors, Ideal Toys, who's no longer around anymore, so I guess I can say this. Ideal Toys brought out a Darcy doll to compete with Barbie. And they started to get some traction. They started to get some space at retail and what have you. So we did a promotion that was basically turn in your Darcy doll and get a brand new Barbie for $2. Well, guess what? All these girls came into retail stores with their Darcy dolls and turned them in. And of course, this wasn't really too popular with retailers because they had to throw all these dolls away. And but it basically killed the competition. And it started something that I used to call the incipiency theory of marketing, where don't let them get a foothold.
Right.
Kill them before they get a foothold. Stop the competitor in its tracks. And Barbie did that back then, and I think they're still trying to do it today.
Yeah, sounds a little bit similar to the Colin Powell doctrine, right? Like overwhelming force.
That's right.
And then in terms of Hot Wheels, those seem like two completely different products.
Yeah, they obviously are.
Were you selected to work on Hot Wheels just because of all of your success behind Barbie, or what was the story?
Yeah, well, I just kept getting promoted. And so as you got promoted, you had more brands under you. And so
I
went from just preschool to having dolls in preschool and under me, Barbie dolls and other dolls under me, to then having the boys' toys under me, which Hot Wheels was a part of. And it was kind of a similar situation. You know, they were used to doing things pretty much the same way.
Right.
And the business, again, had declined. And the marketing of it was, as you probably are aware, in Matchbox, which later I ended up working on. But Matchbox was an English competitor, and they were considered very high-quality collectible die-cast cars, whereas Hot Wheels were considered very stylish and very fast and speed-oriented die-cast cars. And so the marketing of it was pretty much racing, speed, that sort of thing, which was okay. But it wasn't, the play wasn't good enough, in my opinion. You needed to, so I mean, how many times can you just make the car go fast down a sidewalk or a living room floor?
Right.
And so we changed it a bit. We still kept the collectible aspect. We did 75 cars every year, 1 through 75. And we tried to keep them stylish and tried to have the vehicles that boys were most interested in, whether that was Corvettes or Ferraris or Camaros or Ford Mustangs or what have you. But we also introduced a play set that was very popular. And it, strangely enough, was a garage that folded into a case. And in the case, you could carry lots of Hot Wheels cars.
Right.
Well, this worked really well. It was kind of, in a sense, a hardware-software strategy, because once the boys got the garage, they wanted to fill it with Hot Wheels cars.
Right.
And so that worked pretty well. And again, the business grew very, very nicely. I had a couple of very good product managers actually working on it for me, and very competent guys. Very good designers, too. I mean, our design guys were just terrific on the Hot Wheels brand in terms of, you know, the right colors, the right flames coming out of the back, that kind of thing.
I mean,
they really knew how to style die-cast cars very, very well. And so it, again, became a nice big business, a growing business for Mattel.
Right. And so it sounds like really the trick there was you saw that there was this desire for the audience to collect. And then in today's like free-to-play gaming business, we call it progression objectives. But you basically created like that objective, like on the map, you want to get here.
Yes.
And so that's what helped drive the sales. So that's fantastic. All right. And then you guys launched a new brand, which was He-Man. It'd be great to also hear the story behind.
He-Man's the story. He-Man's a great story. And so at the time, Mattel, the only male action figure that Mattel had was a character called Big Jim. Now, Big Jim, I don't know if you remember this at all, it never became a big brand in the United States. He had an arm, when you flexed his arm, you could see the muscle bulge in his bicep. And he was kind of an adventurous guy. They used him for, you know, play pattern in the jungle safari and that sort of thing. Well, meanwhile, Hasbro had not only G.I. Joe, which was a big business, but they also acquired the Kenner Corporation, which had Star Wars. Uh-huh. And so Kenner was just, Hasbro was a massive male action brand. And they had both G.I. Joe and Star Wars. And we had Big Jim, who wasn't so big. And so, again, back to research. We started with research. And we did a lot of research on every theme you can imagine. I mean, everything. If you thought policemen, firemen, Marvel characters, DC characters, whatever the latest TV show characters were, cowboys and Indians. And out of that research, this strange muscular guy with a enemy with a skull face, became Skeletor, won the research.
Okay.
And so after doing the research on drawings, we actually physically sculpted He-Man. And as you can tell by my muscular physique, I mean, sculpted him after me. No, that's not true. And anyway, so we then had models to research against Star Wars and G.I. Joe. And again, He-Man was very, very popular versus the two leading brands in the industry. So we went ahead and we did a line of He-Man and his buddies and Skeletor as an enemy. And he had a group of henchmen. And He-Man and Skeletor would fight it out in Castle Grayskull. So that was the basic storyline. Well, the storyline was actually more elaborate than that. There was this Prince Adam in the planet Eternia, who was a meek sort of princely guy, and he had this rather shy cat. When he raised his sword and yelled, "I have the power," he turned into He-Man.
Right.
And so that was the one of the things that we used in the original commercials and in the original comic book that we did. And Skeletor, again, was this very bad guy, always trying to do bad things. And so anyway, it became about a $75 million brand. Well, by then, by the way, I was president of the whole toy company.
Right.
And the chairman came into my office one day and he said, "Well, it's nice you developed this $75 million business, but it can never be a huge business the way Hasbro has a huge male action business because you don't have a movie or a TV show and you can't get one." And I said, "Do you want to bet?" So I knew this. Our advertising agency at the time was Ogilvy & Mather, and one of the guys who had left it was a guy named Eddie Smarten, who had worked in the television industry for years. And I worked with Eddie and said, "How do we get a television show done?" And we went and talked to CBS and ABC and NBC, and they weren't interested. So Eddie said, "Well, let's do it as a syndicated show." And I didn't even know what that was at the time. And he explained it to me. We were going to do a show that would be on after school at 3 or 4 in the afternoon or 5 in the afternoon. And we were going to sell it to each local television station across the country. And so I said, "Well, gee, well, how many episodes do we need?" He said, "We're going to need a lot." And we figured it out. We were going to need 65 episodes. And it was going to cost us $7.5 million to do. And I thought, "Wow, that's too much money." He said, "Well, we're going to get a partner." And we went and visited Westinghouse, Group W Westinghouse, who owned a lot of television stations across the country. And they said, "You know, it's a pretty good idea. We showed them, obviously, scripts that Eddie had developed.
Right.
And we'll get this going." And so we then worked with Filmation Studios to do the animation and do the production. We worked with a guy who's now famous called Chaim Saban to do the music. And of course, is a billionaire today,
yeah.
Owns Telemundo and a bunch of other stuff. And at one point, he owned what was Fox Kids. Anyway, so long story short, Mattel put up $3.5 million, and Group W Westinghouse put up $3.5 million roughly. And we went around to the local television stations, and instead of selling it, we gave it to them. And this had, I don't think this had been done before. And in return, we got, depending on the negotiation, but basically 4 or 5 spots per half hour that we could use for advertising, not He-Man, that would have been illegal, but to advertise other children's products, or we could sell them. We could sell those spots to McDonald's or to Nike or to any other children's company that was interested in advertising on this television show. So anyway, that's what we did. And lo and behold, we did not expect to make money off the television show. We did this to build the brand, obviously. And the ratings were so high on the television show that we ended up making a profit off of the television show. And of course, the impact of the television show on the brand was enormous. And by the way, at the end of each episode of the television show, you know, at the end of the 28-minute episode, there would be a moral message or an ethical message. So if the show was about not bullying, at the end there would be a message about, remember kids, don't bully your friends at school or whatever. So we had a message at the end of each episode. And the show became immensely popular. The brand grew from $75 million to $750 million.
Wow.
And it obviously lasted a very long time. And every now and then they try to bring it back. So far, I don't think they've done it that successfully, but I believe they're going to try again. I think I heard for next year.
Right. Great. And so then that takes us to kind of the story behind Sega, which was pretty well chronicled in Console Wars, but maybe you could speak to, you know, when you first did, and I think that's a famous story, but if you could just speak to, like, what was the key reason that motivated you to join Sega of America, and, like, what was it that you saw in the opportunity?
Well, sure. I obviously was aware of Nintendo and Sega. I had been involved a little bit with trying to do some products for Nintendo. And I didn't like Nintendo very much, to tell you the truth. I thought they were, talk about a bully. They were a big bully. And they bullied retailers, and they bullied the software developers, and they bullied the licensees. So I wasn't terribly fond of them to start with. And then as the story in Console Wars goes, I mean, the Hayao Nakayama, the chairman CEO of Sega, was very persistent in trying to attract me to the company. He had tried years before. We knew each other because you're probably not aware of this, but at one time Sega was owned by Paramount Pictures.
Oh.
And Sega reported to Barry Diller and Mike Eisner. And Hayao Nakayama at the time was a VP of marketing. And so I knew him from those days because we did a lot of work with Paramount, and we try to license things to Paramount, and they would try to license things to us. So I had a familiarity with Sega from that time. And Hayao was just very persistent in trying to get me to join the company. And
right.
What really sold me was I had not seen 16-bit technology. You know, it wasn't really, it just had come out. And
right.
And I flew to New York, I flew to Tokyo, and I was knocked out by 16-bit technology in terms of the difference between 16-bit and of course what I was aware of at Mattel was in television, and I certainly was aware of 8-bit technology, Master System and NES, and I thought this was just spectacular technology, and that the gameplay was so much better and the graphics were so much better and the involvement was so much better. That's what sold me. I thought, you know, with this technology, this breakthrough, we really have a chance to take on Nintendo.
Got it. You know, so both of us have, you know, worked for Sega, you in a much more prominent and important position, but I don't know if you noticed this, but when I actually visited Japan and I actually got a chance to meet Nakayama-san, is that I noticed this kind of weird, well, not weird, but just kind of unusual characteristic of all the top execs. They all had some kind of animal thing, like Nakayama, he had like this eagle belt. And somebody else had like this bear statue, and like all the top execs had some kind of animal thing. I don't know if you noticed that as well.
I did notice that. I thought it was strange, and it was some kind of company. If you got to a certain level, you had to be part of.
Yeah, I should actually get one just to see if that helps me out in the future. But anyway, and it, maybe we could like just talking about some of the situation for today and some of the brands for today. And just even in terms of the video game space today, some of the biggest video games are based on franchise IP like League of Legends and the League of Legends characters, Call of Duty, Madden, World of Warcraft. So in your opinion, how should game companies think about, you know, trying to build those kinds of brands for games?
Well, and I think it's very similar to the way we actually built Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay.
At Sega, you know, we had a really good first game, but in my opinion, Sonic 2 was actually the best game that during my time of being at Sega that was done. And so the point there being that you have a successful game, but then the next one better be even better if you want to keep that audience excited and happy and growing with you. And I think I guess that you try to do that every time, right? You want to have your next iteration even better. And I would say that the Madden guys have done that very, very well for years and years and years. I mean, I think they might have had a couple hiccups in there, but most of the time there was a clear improvement in the Madden game that was coming out for the next year. And of course, the joke then became whoever they put on the package cover would end up being a failure as a player the next year. But the games itself were very, very good. And I think that was true. Certainly, it was certainly true with what we did with Sonic. I think after I left, there were some Sonic games that weren't so terrific. But I believe they've gotten back on course and are now again doing product that is an improvement each time. And certainly the, you know, the League of Legends guys and the World of Warcraft, those guys have really done a good job of improving on the product each time they bring a new iteration out. And of course, the other part of it is timing. You know, got to get your timing right. You know, you don't want to do it too soon, but you certainly don't want to be too late when you're bringing it out. And of course, now as everyone knows, the day you bring out games is Tuesday, but which started with Sonic Tuesday. But anyway, I think that's quite interesting. And you know, in the case of video games, it's interesting to me that most of the time, the movies or TV shows that have been done haven't been great. I think the Sonic movie was terrific. I actually really enjoyed it. And I think, of course, the TV shows we did back in the early 90s were pretty good, too. But most of the time, the other companies have not done such a great job with it. I can't think of a movie based on a video game that I really enjoyed. What was that one with?
Angry Birds?
Yeah. And now, of course, looking at today, I'm really interested to see what happens. What is Niantic going to do next with Pokemon Go? You know, what is going to be the new thing that they come out with to keep the Pokemon Go franchise growing? And my understanding is that everybody's still waiting for the next headset, AR glasses to be developed. And there's rumors that Apple's working on it. So maybe that'll be the direction that helps them with that particular brand.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds like what you're saying with respect to brands is that there's got to be this level of quality that you deliver, but also it sounds like in terms of continuing to have the next improvement, like a sort of heartbeat where right. You could think of a brand as kind of a living thing where you have to have that quality, but you also have to have this cadence of things happening with that brand.
Well, and I think the other thing is that to me, most of these great games are based on a great story. You know,
right.
the Sonic story is a great story. Now, Madden's not a great story. It's just it's football. But most of the other brands are based on a story that keeps evolving. And I think the developers learn to find out what the game players within those games really liked, and then to use that more and more and more in the next iteration of that game. So I think a lot of this is based on having great stories that people can relate to, people get really involved in. You know, a whole other segment of this is the board game, the Wizards of the Coast kind of people that where the story keeps evolving.
And
to me, that's a real important point, too, to really understand the player, but also understand the story and how to keep it growing.
Right. And Tom, you've kind of done two things. You've taken existing brands and revitalized them, and you've built new brands. And so when you think about both of these cases, can you tell us about what is your thought process behind the two? Do you think of them similarly, or how should we be thinking of them in different terms?
Yeah, that's an interesting question for me, because I hadn't really thought about it that much, other than to say I'm back on where we started with complacency and arrogance. I think there certainly was complacency involved in many of the turnarounds that I was involved with, because the product managers and the creative people had just gotten used to doing things the same old way year after year after year. They assumed it was the right way to do it, but yet the business results were not proving them correct. And so you have to come in and shake it up and do things differently. And then, of course, to the point we were talking about, do the research, find out what that audience really wants. What is the marketplace really looking for?
Right.
And figure out a way of delivering it to them. I don't think everything should be based on research. I mean, I think pure brilliance is often responsible for wonderful, wonderful products. And I think we've seen that in both the toy world and the video game world. And certainly our long departed now, Steve Jobs, didn't believe in research at all. You know, he just wanted to do things the way he wanted them done. And it was brilliant and they worked. So it's not necessarily something you have to have. But in many of the cases for a turnaround, I think it's important to have the data and the insights to know what your market wants. In terms of new games, new products, maybe it's more you start with just pure brilliance and you don't need as much research initially, but eventually you're going to need it because you're going to have to figure out how to keep that brand growing.
Right. So kind of sounds like if you're thinking about either reviving an old brand or creating a new one, to your point about what we talked about before, if you understand that there's an opportunity with a customer, with a specific audience, and then not really being complacent or trusting that the existing processes, the existing products and market are serving those well, but if you can see where that opportunity is, then try to figure out how to best attack those markets with research, with what you're calling brilliance, your own intuition and things of that nature.
I think that's right. And by the way, the brilliance isn't often mine. The brilliance is usually the designers or creative people or even the marketing people that work for me.
All right. So, Tom, thanks so much for your time today. I have one final question, which would be, as a former Sega employee, I'm going to have to ask, if you were running Sega today, what would you do? How would you revive Sonic to be even bigger than he is today?
Oh, that's a great question. One of the things that shocked me when I saw the movie come out and it was the number one movie for 2 weeks in a row, I think.
Right.
There was no new game.
Right.
There was no new game alongside the movie. What an opportunity missed, you know?
Yeah.
People who loved that movie would have probably immediately run to buy the game based on the movie, and they didn't have it. So they missed an opportunity there. And obviously, I feel very strongly about the Sonic brand, and I think they should continue to do great products based on Sonic and his family of friends. And I think that's something they're missing. But one of the other things that struck me is when I think back on all, and I hear they are doing some things. I guess there was an article recently that Golden Axe is coming back. I think I saw something about that.
I read something about that as well.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole catalog of original Sega IP from before I was even there, and certainly while I was there, a great product that they could be resurrecting. Because let's face it, the audience has changed dramatically. And as you know, over half the audience is now well over 21 years of age. And I think the Sony says the average age of the player today is 31 or something. So there's a lot of people who remember back when they were teenagers and they played with this IP and would love to get their hands on it again. So I think Sega should open up that catalog of IP and really give some hard thought to how do they make some of these things come alive again on the new platforms where the graphics and the gameplay can be even better than it, well, far better than it was in the 16-bit world, and bring these products back. I just don't understand why they aren't doing it. And I one of my good friends is the guy who developed Echo the Dolphin. I loved Echo the Dolphin. Why aren't they bringing back? Imagine Echo the Dolphin on the new platforms today. It would be. It was a work of art. It was beautiful back in 16. But imagine what it would look like today.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay, those are all of my questions, Tom. Again, thank you so much for your time. I definitely appreciate it. And there we have it, Tom Kalinske, the king of brands. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Joseph. It's very nice of you to say, but I don't think I'm the king of anything.
Good to meet you, Tom.
Okay, bye-bye, Joseph.
All right.